DW Africa Link. Hello and welcome to DW's Africa Link program this Tuesday, the 4th of December. I'm Isaac Mugadi.
And my name is Jane Nyinge. Thanks so much for joining us. We are also live on our Facebook page. That's DW Africa. Please engage with us on the stories that we'll be covering. And you can also debate among yourselves.
That's right indeed, Jane. Coming up, show us commitment to transparency and accountability, and we'll give you the money. The European Union tells the Ugandan government. We hear from an activist.
The donors sometimes also need to cease the rhetoric. They have tried to engage the government, but corruption tendencies continue. Then that means there's something that they're also not doing right.
Zimbabwean doctors strike over working conditions and drugs a shortage.
The strike, which started over the weekend, seems to be spreading because most of the major public hospitals now shutting down key departments.
Plus, French Prime Minister has suspended planned increases to fuel taxes for at least 6 months in response to weeks of sometimes violent protests.
These are some of the stories that we've lined up for you, but first, let's hear what has been happening around the world.
DW News.
This is DW News with me, Zipora Nyambura. The French government has suspended the controversial fuel tax rise for 6 months following weeks of protest. Three people have died and hundreds injured since the unrest began. Prime Minister Edouard Philippe said they would also suspend increases in the cost of gas and electricity set to take place from January 1st.
Notre objectif, c'est que le travail paye, et nous avons bien entendu les Français.
Our objective is that work pays, and we heard well the French people who ask us to accelerate. I'm convinced that if the state must remain strong and firm, it is first the guarant of public peace. Setting course and sticking with it is a necessity in order to govern France, but no tax deserves to put in danger the unity of the nation.
Ne mérite de mettre en danger l'unité de la nation.
The Yellow Vest protest started 3 weeks ago, but have since grown into a revolt against President Emmanuel Macron. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has named Shamila Batohi as the new chief prosecutor. Batohi has worked for the past 9 years as a legal advisor to the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, in The Hague, Fatou Bensouda. She is expected to spearhead the anti-corruption fight. The previous prosecutor, Sean Abrahams, was accused by the opposition and right groups of shielding former President Jacob Zuma from corruption charges during his tenure. The number of African migrants reaching war-torn Yemen is expected to rise to over 150,000 by the end of this year. According to the United Nations, smugglers are taking advantage of the chaos of the war in Yemen to evade security checks. The spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, Joel Milman, said 92% of the migrants are from Ethiopia and Somalia, trying to make their way to reach Gulf countries.
That is a strong selling point, that the war helps smuggling. Of course, once they get there, it's a very different situation. There's minefields to cross. There are exchanges of gunfire that sometimes migrants find themselves in the middle of. There's all kinds of dangerous spots along the border, and we've seen considerable fatalities for the last 3 years of migrants because of that.
The Ebola epidemic continues to spread through the Democratic Republic of Congo, North Kivu province. According to reports from Doctors Without Borders, the newest areas to be affected include the city of Butembo and a number of isolated areas that are hard to reach. So far, 440 people have been infected with the virus, of whom 255 have died. Cameroon has freed 52 opposition activists who protested against the re-election of 85-year-old Paul Biya. Lawyer Emmanuel Sims said the Justice Ministry had ordered their release. The activists were arrested at the end of October in Douala, demonstrating against the re-election of Biya, who had won a seventh consecutive term. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I am Zipora Nyambura.
And you are listening to Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jane Nyinge. This broadcast is also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. So please talk to us on that platform and also feel free to share the video. Now, the European Union has urged the Ugandan government to renew its commitment to uphold democracy and human rights before it can release 66 million euros to support the country's judicial sector.
Uganda has on several occasions been in the spotlight for violation of freedom of assembly, press freedoms, extrajudicial killings and absence of accountability. Frankiga has more.
In an exclusive interview with Africa Link, EU ambassador to Uganda, Attilio Pacific, said the government is taking long to accept its terms of ensuring that its citizens enjoy basic freedoms as enshrined in the country's constitution.
The conditions for this amount were several, mainly related to accountability, transparency, the way the government has structured its procurement process, and so all issues for which the government is fully compliant, except one condition, which is about the government stating its firm determination to join the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative to appoint a coordinator to implement this initiative in Uganda. I cannot understand why this is not happening.
Sisi Kagaba of Anti-Corruption Coalition Uganda said that it is time for the European Union to walk the talk and stop giving Uganda funds for failing to respect human rights and accounting for funds that it has received in the past.
The donors sometimes also need to cease the rhetoric. They have tried to engage the government, but corruption tendencies continue. Then that means there's something that they're also not doing right. We need to see them demonstrate that they can withhold funding. The money they give is not used for right purposes. So why don't they withhold funding until we see some action, especially in the areas of governance and human rights?
Contrary to what Sisi Kagaba is suggesting to withhold funding to government, Miriam Matembe, a renowned human rights activist, says the European Union should instead divert funds to strengthen civil society organizations to sensitize Ugandans about their constitutional rights.
They keep funding the government more rather than funding, for instance, the civil society organizations, which can mobilize the citizens and educate them about their rights so that they can be able to stand up for their rights.
That report was by Frank Iga about how the EU wants to dictate terms to Uganda. Now, Jane, we asked on our Facebook page to what extent should development partners dictate terms when giving aid and grants to African countries. We have so many comments here,
absolutely,
right? But before we go to them, let's listen to what some Ugandans had to say about this particular story.
I don't think they should, because in most cases when these agencies decide to help us, they usually expect something in return, which is not fair. Because I believe we are civilized people, and we can sort this out.
I don't think it's a fair thing. We can sort ourselves. We can sort ourselves as Ugandans. And I don't think the European Union can come in and help us.
I think the European Union should have an influence in our politics and everything. Why? Because these people need to be checked, because to some extent they will feel like they have a lot of power or they are left. I mean, there should be someone to check us in order for us to be in line. Yeah, that's my opinion.
They have to empower people. They have to teach people. They have to tell them what human rights is, the importance of human rights. So by empowering people, by informing them about what the importance of human rights are, people will be able to know their rights so that they cannot be abused. I think the European Union, they have to play some role.
Those were the voices of ordinary Ugandans, Jen.
And on our Facebook page, Edrisa Sayang says, that is not Idrisa, but Yoge Boni says Uganda is host to the greatest numbers of refugees in Africa. And on that note, they deserve every possible aid with less tension.
I like that, with less tension. Our usual contributor, Isaac Ehoza Godwin, says until the funds given are properly appropriated and accountability is certain.
And Oyema Daniel says, hypocrisy of the highest level. These same foreign donors have been pumping loan upon loan to Nigeria without these conditionalities, despite it being an open secret that the country is notoriously corrupt and home to largest population of extreme poor in the world. That is your observation, Oyema.
Mm-hmm. And Mefa Jones says, he asks, Do African countries need aid and grants? Same question I have here, Jen, for you. Do you think they need grants and aid?
At times we do.
Okay. Well said then. Now, the French government has announced that it is suspending an unpopular rise in fuel tax that was due to take effect next month. In a televised address, Prime Minister Edouard Philippe said the diesel and gas hikes would be delayed for 6 months.
Now, Philippe urged members of the anti-tax rise movement to end their violent protest, which shut down central Paris over the weekend. The so-called Yellow Vest protest began in mid-November and have since evolved into wider revolt against President Macron. For more on the suspension, let's listen to DW's Lisa Louis in Paris.
The Prime Minister has also announced that a national debate will be launched by mid-December where everybody could take part and talk about France's tax system. He said the government understands that this is not very transparent, that the French need to understand better what's happening in their country, and that they could also talk about bringing down taxes. But he reminded people of the fact that if you brought down taxes, that would also mean that public spending would have to go down. Otherwise, France would get into trouble on a European level.
For more than 3 weeks, tens of thousands of French people have been expressing their anger at roundabouts, in shopping areas, and in the streets of many French towns. This anger has deep roots. It's been brewing for a while. It often stayed quiet, out of discretion or pride. Today, it is being expressed with force and in a collective way. One must be deaf or blind not to hear or see it.
French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe.
Let's now go back to Africa, and Zimbabwe's medical doctors have downed their tools and are demanding better working conditions and salaries. The strike, which began over the weekend, has forced major public hospitals in the country to close down key departments and discharging stable patients.
For some time now, Zimbabwe's health system has been on the brink of collapse. For more on the situation in the country, I spoke to our correspondent, Privilege Mushani. Take a listen.
The strike, which started over the weekend, seems to be spreading because most of the major public hospitals now shutting down key departments, particularly those outpatient departments where they have to admit patients. They are now considering that if you are not critically ill, then they send you home. Initially, it was junior doctors, but now senior doctors have also joined in the strike. And this is not looking good for already the paralyzed health system in Zimbabwe.
Maybe just at this point, you know, for the sake of our listener, tell us a little bit about the state of Zimbabwe's health system before this ongoing strike.
We are just coming out from a cholera outbreak. Mm-hmm. And already the health system had been shaken. And also you find that in terms of provision of critical drugs, it is also a problem because the country is short of foreign currency to import drugs. So already the health system was facing a huge challenge. And doctors as well, in terms of the issues of money, they are now demanding that they want to be paid in foreign currency because they are saying that their salaries have been eroded and the money that they are earning is worthless.
Mm-hmm. Looks like, you know, a breakdown of the system is looming. Anyway, what are the implications in case the government and doctors do not come to an immediate agreement?
This is not looking good because already we have two regions in the country, in the north and the south, where cholera outbreak has been recorded. Mm-hmm. Already in the north, in a place called Mount Darwin, there are two people who died, and by last weekend, 139 cases of cholera had been recorded. So this is just outside Harare, the capital. But if you come back to Harare, you find Harare and Bulawayo are the cities that have the major referral hospitals where everyone who is coming from any other province, if they have a critical disease or they want to have a major operation, they are referred to these hospitals. And then if doctors are not working, it's not looking good because there's no one to attend to them.
Our own Privilege Mushanri giving us an insight on the situation in Zimbabwe's health sector. Now, Jen, I think we can give a shout out to our listeners, you know, on Facebook. Monji Enel says, greetings to you all. Thank you, Monji. Jiman Jimmy says, hello, DW. How are you doing? Well, Jimmy, we are doing well. And of course, more of you are still commenting on the stories that we are covering. Keep it up. This is Africa Link program coming to life from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. This broadcast is also live on our Facebook page at DW Africa. And I can see Modur Sar, you are already there. Thanks so much for joining us. And we have Omutala Ba in Cameroon. Thank you so much for joining us. So coming up in the next 15 minutes, we hear from a lawyer turned peacemaker in Nigeria who has even been nicknamed by Boko Haram as Mom. But how has she managed to win their hearts?
The only way out is to mellow down. Look at them like children that went astray, stubborn kids.
Great story there coming up. And in Namibia, Herero women have decided to stick to their traditional attire that was brought to them by German colonialists over 100 years ago. Can you imagine, Jen?
Those are so many years ago.
Yeah.
And it's good that they've decided to retain that attire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but first, let's head to Nigeria. Aisha Wakil, a lawyer turned negotiator, is making headlines for working closely with Boko Haram militants in northern part of the country.
Her work has been well documented by a Nigerian journalist, Chika Odua, in half an hour film. The documentary was screened in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. DW's Oyesu Abubakar Idris attended the event and now brings us more on the story.
Aisha Wakil is a lawyer turned peacemaker. In the film, she is seen as a fearless because of her close links with the militant group Boko Haram. Aisha played an important role in the release of the Chibok girls kidnapped by the militant group in 2014. Chronicles her work and how Boko Haram trusted her to the level of calling her their mommy. Chika Odua is a producer of the film. She explains to me what attracted her to Aisha's work.
Well, I first heard her story about 2 years ago, and I was immediately intrigued because, number one, she's a female, and her access to these people known as Boko Haram terrorists, while many people may hate them, she loves them. I have met some members of Boko Haram who say wholeheartedly that they trust this woman. They trust her more than the government, with so much, you know, confidence that this woman will not fail them. So for me, that was very interesting right away.
Although Aisha Wakil has been successful in her work, she has at the same time faced many challenges. In fact, she was once a wanted person by the Nigerian army. She shares her frustrations, but believes there is hope.
The only way out is to mellow down. Look at them like children that went astray, stubborn kids. So there are a lot of criminality in Boko Haram now that they use that group in doing some illegal activities. Go down the grass. I keep on telling government, go down the grass. Those up there cannot do it because they are down there. They have to use people on ground, people on the grass. I keep on saying this, but they don't seem to listen. But I'm still doing what I'm doing. They are shooting. Is it ending? It's not ending.
There were clapping and standing ovations from many Nigerians as the film was screened in the capital, Abuja. But what message does Chika Odua want to send out through her film? And can it impact the search for peace? She explains.
I want to show that women have solutions in this country. There are solutions that are not being properly utilized. So I want people to know that there is an alternative solution besides military strategy alone. So if we have people like Mama and other women, it's not just Mama. I've met so many women who are doing things in their own way to restore peace. If these people are known to the general public, perhaps they can get more support to take their works on a larger scale.
Fatima Abakaka is a woman activist with the Bring Back Our Girls campaigners. She has been following Aisha Wakil's work.
She has achieved a lot, more than even what the men have done, because hers is like a peacemaker, a negotiator. She reaches out to the Boko Haram. The impact relies on the government. If the government will buy into it, if the government will watch the video, if the video will be like a leverage for the government to work on, especially the military.
As the search for peace continues in Nigeria to end over 9 years of Boko Haram insurgency, Aisha remains an important link to reach out to the militant group, which has now split into three factions.
DW's Uwaisu Abubakar, and Isaac, I must say, she's such an incredible woman, this Aisha Wakil, because winning the hearts of Boko Haram,
yes, to the
and they can
of,
trust you.
Exactly, to the extent of calling her mommy.
Mommy.
Or mom. She's incredible indeed, I think so. Tell us what you think about this story by going to our Facebook page, DW Africa. Would like to hear from you. And of course, we'll read your comments live here on air whenever we can.
Africa on the move.
Fashion keeps on changing, but Herero women in Namibia have decided to stick to the traditional attire that was brought to them by German's colonialist like 100 years ago. Designer McBride Kavari is giving a new life, especially to the iconic Herero dress.
She says the move will make the dress more appealing to young Namibians because they want to stick to their tradition and at the same time look modern. DW's Stefan Moll got an opportunity to talk to Kavari just to get a clear picture of what he wants to achieve, and his report is presented by Wanjiko Maura.
Embellished skirts, bright colors, and the iconic three-pointed hat. These are the trademarks of designer McBride Kavari's work. In a world of fashion where African patterns are becoming increasingly popular, the 25-year-old Namibian embraces the Victorian heritage that once came from Europe to Namibia.
It tells us who we are. It tells us more about where we came from, who we represent. It makes us be who we are individually.
His modern Herero dresses have traveled to catwalks across the continent and Europe. For Kavari, the dresses are much more than just a fashion statement. Originally, German missionaries ordered Hereros to wear Victorian-style clothing. The animal-herding people appropriated the dress code in their own way and added special features such as the colorfully printed fabrics and the headgear resembling the horns of cattle. This way, the Herero turns the humiliation into a triumph. Kavari continues this tradition with a modern twist.
Especially when I get criticism regarding my designs, I would say what makes a Herero dress be a Herero dress is basically the headgear, that is the cow horns. Otherwise, one can play around with it, have it short, have it sleeveless, have it either way you want to.
His fashion shows often spark heated debates over whether his gowns are an insult to the sensitive history of the Herero people by being too revealing. However, many young people like Kasuko Zakapi appreciate Kavari's unique take on the dress.
They're beautiful, like wherever you go, everybody will just be like, oh, that you look beautiful on it. You know, I love fashion, so you go to a wedding, you would want to wear the latest and all that. Yeah, it's very beautiful. That's why I love it.
Kavari grew up in Windhoek. He made his first designs at the age of 13 when his mother brought him a sewing machine. At 16, he had his first major fashion show in Berlin, here in Germany, featuring the Herero dress. As a designer, Kavari wants to reach to the young generation. He hopes that his designs can help young Hereros be proud of who they are and where they come from.
I know it's so difficult to accept the change. After every fashion show, you'll get comment, people criticizing and trying to, you know, punch you for what you have done on the dress. But after all, I know the change is not easy, but after all, the change also makes the young people get to fall in love with the dress and just carry wearing and loving our traditional attire.
While the Herero dress stands for tradition and identity, it also shows that a change of fashion is not reserved for Western designers who are increasingly making use of ethnic African patterns. The ensemble of traditional European and African elements in Kavari's work is proudly turning the tables.
Thanks, Wanjiko, with that report that was compiled by Stefan Moll.
And Isaac, you come from Rwanda. Do you have a particular national dress for
Rwandese?
It's
a traditional attire, and I can tell you it's really very beautiful. It's called Umushanana.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And, you know, it looks like, you know, a sari, an Indian sari, But I mean, the ladies, when they put it on, you know, they look really elegant.
I can imagine. But for us, it was, I come from Kenya, and it's been difficult for us to settle on one national attire. And that is why we still stick to the Maasai attire. So we call it our dress. Okay. The Maasai.
They should charge each tribe, you know, for taking their attire as their own, you know. I mean, anyway, we still have much more for you, so don't go. We'll be back just right after this.
Focus Europe.
Now, when you think about refugees and boats, and what might first spring to mind are the images of overcrowded inflatable boats, desperate people risking their lives for a new life, and sadly, drownings at sea.
Now, an ambitious art project in Berlin wants to challenge that perception by working with refugees to build a luxury boat to explore the city's extensive waterways and create a floating space for dialogue. Guy Idegen visited the Making Waves project to find out more.
Perched on top of the upturned hull of an 8-meter-long wooden boat, Hannah Aldorado deftly wields an electric sander back and forth to smooth out bumps on plywood panels. Most weekdays, the 26-year-old Syrian, originally from Homs, is hard at work on the boat, which is taking shape in the courtyard of a large studio for artists in Berlin's Wedding district. Hannah fled the civil war in Syria and arrived in Germany in 2016. Through a city employment program for refugees, Hannah found out about the Making Waves project. He's one of a core group of about 6 refugees who are step-by-step building a luxury wooden motor yacht by hand for the first time.
We want to give the refugee community the idea that boats are not just something bad. We want to give those people another experience of boats, that they are not just something they need to be afraid when they are on it. It can be also something fun, something safe.
Making Waves was conceived by Dan Seipel, an American artist living in Berlin. Seipel explains that there are many artistic and psychological layers to the project.
I knew that this is a project that created a safe space in which we could talk about something so deep. And in the boat, create an object, a collective object, that had all of those psychologies. So the workshop invites people to build a boat, but it sets up a context to talk about questions of identity, assimilation, the difficulties of traveling here. Where people have come from, where do people want to go to?
None of the refugees participating in the project have ever built a boat before. How the finished vessel will be used is up to the refugees building it. Seipel says they're talking about organizing day trips, making the boat available to rent, or even selling it. Seipel himself sees the boat as a potential form of escape, a form of leisure, and something that is luxurious. He launched a crowdfunding campaign and raised more than 20,000 euros to start the Making Waves project. Later in the morning, another Syrian refugee, Hassan Aji, arrives to work on the boat following his German class. For the 24-year-old from Damascus, the boat has a special significance. Hassan crossed from Turkey to the Greek island of Symi on board a wooden vessel about the same size as what he's now helping to build. He's on track to have his pharmacy degree recognized, and together with German language certification, he'll soon be able to look for a job as a pharmacist. But finishing the boat is very important to him.
Now people can see it's a real boat. Now it has its shape. People can identify it. For me, that's a huge motivation to keep working, and we want to finish it. We want to sail with it. Yeah, that's kept me motivated the whole time.
Artist Dan Seipel is confident that come next spring, the Making Waves luxury motor yacht will be ready for launch, ready to explore Berlin, and ready for conversations about the refugee experience.
Guy Dejean with that interesting report there about the luxury boat that is being built by migrants. What do you think of that story, Jane?
It's really interesting and encouraging, because when you think of how most refugees have gotten to Europe, they go through a harrowing experience. So it will bring another picture altogether.
Exactly. Especially that it will be, you know, going through the waterways of Berlin. I would like once to ride on it and have that experience, yeah. You too. Anyway, thanks for joining us. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. Thank you so much for your time.
DW. Made
for minds.